My name is Fred Logevall, and I am delighted to welcome you to this talk this afternoon. I am a faculty member in the History Department, and I'm also I'm the director of the Mario Einaudi Center for International Studies. Today's talk is one of a series of discussions that we're having at Einaudi as part of our distinguished speaker series, distinguished foreign policy speaker series, which has been in existence now for several years. And what we try to do in this series, as many of you know, I think because you've been with us before, is we try to bring in to Ithaca, we bring to campus people in various walks of life who are experts on something pertaining to world affairs, who can enlighten us, who can speak to us at Cornell on their topic of expertise, and we can have a discussion, a debate here in Ithaca on the subject at hand. Today's topic, obviously, is highly pertinent to this. Some of you will remember in the 2008 presidential campaign when Barack Obama, and I'm paraphrasing, but Barack Obama basically said that Afghanistan is the good war, and he wanted to distinguish it from the bad war, which was Iraq. And then as president in his first term, expanded American involvement in Afghanistan. More recently, the president has said that our war will be over by the end of 2014. He has insisted, as politicians do, that the mission will be completed, will be successful, I think it's fair to say. And I think to have an opportunity today to hear about the situation in Afghanistan, what we're currently seeing there, what we can expect to see, what we have seen in the war to this point, I think is a real privilege. Before I introduce our speaker, I do want to say that we are very grateful at Einaudi for the support that we receive for our foreign policy initiative, of which this is a part, that we receive from the Sao Giacomo Charitable Foundation, from the Kessler Foundation, the Kessler family, rather, from Mrs. Judy Biggs, and also from the Bartels family. And I also want to say that we have another event coming up in this same foreign policy distinguished speaker series. We will have Eric Alterman, who is distinguished professor of English and journalism at Brooklyn College and a columnist for The Nation. Eric Alterman, and who is also a Cornell alum, Eric Alterman will be here to speak on the subject of the search for a liberal foreign policy. The search for a liberal foreign policy on Monday, April 22nd, right here in this room, and we look forward very much to that talk. And so I hope you will be here for that. Also, as always, look at our web calendar for more information about upcoming events. We're already starting to plan for the fall. A very exciting lineup of speakers coming to us in a few months' time. Today, however, we are delighted, and I am honored to be able to introduce Rajiv Chandrasekaran, who will give a talk on the topic of the surge to uncertainty, an examination of America's strategy in Afghanistan. Rajiv Chandrasekaran is a senior correspondent and associate editor of the Washington Post. He is the author of Little America, The War Within the War for Afghanistan, which appeared in June 2012. I should say, by the way, that over to my right we have books for sale. I see that some of them have already been sold, but we have, at a terrific price, copies of this book available if you're interested after the talk. And I dare say that our guest probably can be persuaded to sign said book as well. From 2009 to 2011, he reported on the war in Afghanistan for the Post, traveling extensively throughout the southern provinces of Helmand and Kandahar to reveal the impact of President Obama's decision to expand American force levels, and more broadly, obviously, to report on the war in that part of Afghanistan. His first book, Imperial Life in the Emerald City, was a best-selling account of the troubled American effort to reconstruct Iraq. It provides a first-hand view of life inside Baghdad's Green Zone, and when it appeared, it won several awards, including the Overseas Press Book Club Award, the Ron Ridenour Prize, and Britain's Samuel Johnson Prize. Those of you who are students in my Vietnam class will recognize the name Ron Ridenour, of course, in terms of My Lai and the massacre and what he did to disclose what was going on at that particular moment in the war. Emerald Life in the Emeralds, Imperial Life in the Emerald City was also named a best, one of the 10 best books of 2007 by the New York Times. Chandrasekharan joined the Post in 1994 as a reporter on the Metropolitan staff. He has served as the Post national editor and as an assistant managing editor. In 2003 and 4, he was the Post's bureau chief in Baghdad. He also held positions for the Post in Cairo and Jakarta. He has served two terms as a public policy scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington. He has also been the author in residence at the Center for a New American Security and the journalist in residence at the International Reporting Project of the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. He holds degrees in political science, holds a degree in political science from Stanford University, where he was editor-in-chief of the Stanford Daily. I think what this suggests, ladies and gentlemen, is that our guest today is in a particularly great position to speak to us about the war as it begins to, ostensibly at least, as it begins to wind down. I'm delighted to have this chance to introduce him, and I ask you now to join me in welcoming Rajiv Chandrasekharan.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that kind introduction. I'll start off with a confession this afternoon. I really didn't want to write this book. When I set out for my first trip to Afghanistan under the Obama administration in early 2009, I assumed that if there was a book to be written about this phase of the Afghan war, it would be about how President Obama and his national security team managed to reverse years of strategic drift and neglect and turn around a failing war. After spending 2 years in Iraq, watching President Bush's merry band of neoconservative political appointees, some of them inexperienced 20-somethings chosen more for political fidelity than their nation-building expertise. Some of them were asked, for instance, for their views on Roe versus Wade during their hiring interviews at the Pentagon. I expected Team Obama to show us what would happen when the professionals were put in charge. I wasn't thinking that we'd get peace a la Germany or Japan post-World War II, or the Jeffersonian democracy that the neocons so foolishly thought they could birth in Iraq. But I was hopeful that the United States and its NATO allies could return Afghanistan to where it was in late 2001 and early 2002, when the Taliban were on the run and a brighter future seemed a certainty for the Afghan people. Now, when I was on that trip in February of 2009, the president decided to send 17,000 additional troops to the war front. Now, for Obama, Afghanistan had always been the good war, the war that began with two fallen towers, not the war that stemmed from faulty intelligence and exaggerated claims of WMD. In August 2007, then-Senator Obama had declared Afghanistan the war that has to be won. And as a candidate, he had pledged to deploy more troops and increase reconstruction funds to the country. He vowed not to repeat the mistakes of the past when we Americans had turned our backs on Afghanistan. Now, Obama's advisors assumed that that 17,000 troop deployment would be enough to satisfy the Pentagon. And soon after approving those forces, the president signed off on a strategy document that was designed to guide the use of those troops and those that were already on the ground. Obama made clear just weeks into his presidency that his aims in Afghanistan and Pakistan were going to be clear and focused. It was to disrupt, dismantle, and defeat al-Qaeda in both of those nations. But the plan to achieve it was going to be expansive. Instead of focusing simply on capturing or killing senior al-Qaeda leaders, the new White House plan envisaged building an Afghan state that will be strong and stable enough to itself keep out any al-Qaeda leaders who would be foolish enough to return to Afghanistan from the sanctuaries they were enjoying in Pakistan. And that involved doing what the Americans should have done back in 2001 and 2, but what we didn't do because we took our eye off the ball to go invade Iraq. It included building an Afghan government, training a new Afghan army, providing essential services to the Afghan people. But with the Taliban in control of broad swaths of Afghanistan, pulling all that off in 2009 was not going to be nearly as easy as it could have been 8 years earlier. To do so, the military would have to implement a counterinsurgency strategy. COIN, as the acronym-loving military calls it, concentrates not on hunting down guerrillas in a country besieged by an insurgency, but on protecting the civilian population from insurgents. The idea is to separate the good from the bad. Instead of focusing on the bad, focus on the good, and try to deprive the insurgency of the support it needs to sustain itself and expand. But doing that requires resources and it requires time. Protecting civilians means ensuring law and order, providing basic services such as education and health care, setting up a functioning local government, mentoring security forces, and rebuilding the infrastructure. It sounded ambitious, and it sure was. But Afghanistan was the good war, and the price tag didn't seem all that high to the president. He thought he had already paid for most of it with the 17,000 troops that he had approved. Of course, as all of you know, that wasn't enough for the military. The new top commander in Kabul, General Stan McChrystal, would soon ask the president for 40,000 more troops. In an assessment he sent Obama shortly after taking command, McChrystal warned that if NATO forces failed to reverse Taliban momentum within 12 months, defeating the Taliban would no longer be possible. The status quo, he told the president, will lead to failure. Now, McChrystal's request led to a form of sticker shock in the White House. All of a sudden, the COIN strategy that the president had so quickly approved a few months earlier now had a new price tag, a total of about 100,000 U.S. troops on the ground. As a consequence, the president convened a series of meetings with his war cabinet in the White House Situation Room over a series of several weeks in the fall of 2009. Now, those in uniform, General McChrystal, Admiral Mike Mullen, then the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and General Dave Petraeus, who was then in charge of the U.S. Central Command, all argued for more forces. They argued that a troop surge was what had turned around the situation in Iraq, even though the actual facts of the matter were far more complex and nuanced, this being the turnaround in Iraq, and if you even want to call it a turnaround. I would more accurately describe it as a diminution of violence from the peak levels of, during the Civil War, involved a series of factors coming together, of which additional troops was one. But in the White House debates over the Afghan surge, the military was insistent that the surge had been the instrumental factor in Iraq and could do the same sort of thing in Afghanistan. Now, in Afghanistan, however, implementing a counterinsurgency strategy was going to be far more complex than in Iraq. It did not involve simply separating warring parties in a civil war. In Afghanistan, it would have to do something far more challenging. Try to convince the majority ethnic Pashtun population to cast their lot with President Hamid Karzai's government instead of with the insurgency. Problem was that Karzai's administration was often more rapacious and corrupt than the Taliban. So it posed the big question, how could COIN work when the locals were turning to insurgents to protect them from their supposed protectors? COIN also required a lot of patience. It can take years before a besieged population feels safe enough to demonstrate allegiance to their nation. But the commanders downplayed those risks and those costs. Now, civilians in President Obama's war cabinet were not immediately sold on McChrystal's plan. The chief skeptic in the room was Vice President Biden, who doubted the sincerity of President Hamid Karzai, and he questioned whether the Pakistani government would be truly supportive of a more expansive American effort. He argued instead that our military should focus more of its existing resources in the country on trying to kill and capture senior Taliban and al-Qaeda leaders. In these discussions that took place over the course of 2.5 months, Biden really emerged as the most vocal skeptic of counterinsurgency. He was unmoved by the claims voiced by McChrystal and Petraeus and Mullen. In my reporting for the book, I managed to get my hands on a memo that Biden wrote directly to the president after one of these sessions in the Situation Room. And he spells out his concerns about the military's principal justification for more troops. It's only a paragraph long memo. Let me just read it here because I think it's instructive to get a sense of where Biden was very early on in this process. He wrote to Obama, "I do not see how anyone who took part in our discussions could emerge without profound questions about the viability of counterinsurgency. Our military will do its part. They will clear anything we ask them to clear. They will hold anything we ask them to hold. But nobody can tell you with conviction when, and even if, we can produce the flip sides of coin that are required to build and transfer responsibility to the Afghans. An effective and sustainable civilian surge, a credible partner in Kabul, basic governance and services, and competent Afghan security forces. We simply can't control these variables, yet they're essential to the success of COIN." Now, in the end, Obama sided with his commanders. He decided to give them almost all of what they wanted, 30,000 more troops, although he did impose a very significant condition on that surge, that U.S. troops would have to start coming home by the summer of 2011. It was a deadline he took from the military's own planning documents that promised that American troops could clear areas of insurgents and then transfer responsibility to the Afghans in just 18 to 24 months. Now, a month after the president's decision, in January 2010, I was sitting in my office at the Washington Post preparing for yet another trip to Afghanistan. This time, I was going to accompany American Marines, the first wave of these surge forces, as they assaulted a Taliban stronghold in southwestern Afghanistan called Marja. It was a nasty place. There were hundreds of insurgents holed up there. There were bomb-making factories there. Many farms in the area were growing opium-producing poppies, the sales of which were being used to help fund the insurgency. And as I was getting my files together, I decided to at least try to get a sense of this terrain that I would be encountering in just a week or two. And I pulled up Google Earth, and I zoomed in on Marja. And as I sort of went in and looked at this community of farmland surrounded by desert, I noticed something incredibly odd. I noticed what initially looked to me to be wide boulevards, north-south, as razor-sharp as the avenues of Manhattan. Now, it quickly became clear to me that these weren't actually roads, but they were canals, but they were built perfectly straight. And it looked to me like those weird sort of crop circles you see. And it was a clear sign to me that this was not built by local hands. I'd traveled around enough in southern Afghanistan to see that, you know, farm plots there are not demarcated like they are, you know, in the American Midwest with the aid of surveyors and nice 90-degree boundaries. Everything sort of meanders about. But here are these remarkably straight irrigation canals. And so I set about trying to answer for myself the question of who had built these things. Now, it turned out it actually wasn't all that hard to find an answer. It existed in the Library of Congress and the National Archives and the files of the U.S. Agency for International Development. And of course, like everything else in our modern world, the answers were plentiful on the internet. And it's a story I would discover that was suffused with relevant lessons for our most recent attempt at nation building in Afghanistan, but it was a story that few in Washington had bothered to read about or to even connect the basic dots. It's a story that begins quite remarkably with the Holocaust. In the late 1930s, as the Nazis were advancing through Central Europe, many Jews, as we know, were able to flee and made their way to the United States. Among them were many Jewish fur traders. Many of them wound up resettling in the New York area. And as they tried to get back to work, they needed to find a new source for pelts to make coats and hats. And so they turned quite remarkably to the landlocked nation of Afghanistan, whose hills abounded with the Persian fat-tailed sheep. The fleece of their newborn lambs could be turned into lustrous coats and hats. And so in the late 1930s and early 1940s, Afghanistan exported between 1 and 2 million caracol wool pelts a year to the United States. Because of currency exchange controls imposed by the Afghan king, the sales of each pelt put another dollar or two in the king's treasury. So at the end of the Second World War, as Europe was digging out of its rubble, Afghanistan was sitting on a comparative windfall. It had $100 million in gold and silver reserves in its national treasury. Now, the young king in Kabul, 32-year-old Mohammad Zahir Shah, wanted to use this fur money to vault his primitive landlocked nation into the modern era. He'd been really impressed with what the United States had done in the Tennessee Valley during the Great Depression. And he thought perhaps he could do something similar for his country. He had visions of turning the barren desert along the Helmand River in southern Afghanistan into an agricultural oasis, of harnessing the waters of the Hindu Kush to turn it into a breadbasket for his country, to ease the pain of frequent food shortages. And so in 1946, the Afghan king went out and hired the world's best construction firm at that time. It was a San Francisco-based company called Morrison Knudsen. They had built the Hoover Dam and the San Francisco Bay Bridge that later go on to build Cape Canaveral. And using Afghanistan's own money, this wasn't a foreign aid project, he hired a team of American engineers to come in and build a network of irrigation canals and dams across southern Afghanistan. Now, it wasn't just going to be an agricultural development project. The king had a small coterie of advisors who had been sent at great expense to the United States to go to college, and they'd come back to Afghanistan. And for these advisors, this project was going to be also about bringing a bit of America to Afghanistan. They wanted to bring to them, bring to their country, the America that had dazzled them in their school days. They had visions of building new villages with modern schools and health clinics, of resettling nomads, of having families from different tribes live together rather than often separate villages. Girls would be educated. Women would cast off the head-to-toe burqa. Eye for an eye Islamic justice would be replaced with written laws and august courts. Professional government men from Kabul would supplant the gray-bearded elders who were wielding power in the provinces. It was going to be a grand social engineering experiment, and the English-speaking, suit-wearing Afghans who had the king's ear saw in these engineers the ideal partners to transform their nation. Now, unfortunately, this lush agrarian vision soon ran aground. It turns out that the soil in the Helmand River Valley is very salty, and it's not really conducive to growing crops. And when these fields were irrigated, and the Afghans had a tendency to flood their land, the water didn't drain off very well. And what happened was, as the water evaporated, it left even more salts in the soil that continued to stunt anything that was grown there. Now, early on, the Afghan government started to have some reservations about this. And they started to voice this to the Americans. The American contractor's response was simply, you need to do more. You need to build more canals. You need to build a bigger dam in the upriver hills. Now, of course, this exceeded the Afghan government's budget, and so it had to turn to Washington for what would become the first of a series of loans that would later turn into years of foreign assistance to the country. As this project was underway, and more canals were being dug, a big dam was being developed, the American engineers who were there thought they could at least get a start on the social engineering aspects of this project. They had been living in tent camps, and they figured, why don't we build a town for ourselves that the Afghans would aspire to emulate? So smack dab in the middle of the desert of what is now Helmand Province, they set up an 8-square-block town. Now, if any of you have seen pictures of homes in Afghanistan, you know that every single dwelling there is surrounded by a very tall mud or brick wall to keep outsiders from gazing in on one's womenfolk. Well, in this new town, there were no walls. American-style ramblers and white stucco bungalows with manicured green front lawns. The country's first and only co-ed high school, a swimming pool where boys and girls would swim together. They had a clubhouse where there were nightly card games and a bartender who would pour a mean gin and tonic. Now, the Americans thought the Afghans would look at this town and say, ah, we want to abandon our villages and live in such a civilized way. Well, the Afghans looked at all this and said, ah, it's fine for you Americans. We have no desire to live this way. But they did come up with a name for the place. They started to call the town Little America. And that's where I get the title of the book from. Now, on the agricultural side of things, the canal building project turned into a total failure. More canals were dug, but fundamentally, the hoped-for agricultural yields never materialized, in part because of the salinity of the soil and because of other problems that we discovered later. The land was improperly leveled, the canal was built too low to the ground. So in the 1960s, the Afghan government had fired Morrison Knudsen, but the U.S. government, Washington, couldn't afford this project to essentially fall into disrepair. They were worried that if they did, the Soviets, who were already active in northern Afghanistan at that point, would swoop down into the south and establish a key foothold close to Pakistan, which was then a key American ally. So in 1961, the newly created U.S. Agency for International Development sent teams of experts to Afghanistan, and it would soon become one of the largest overseas projects for USAID in the 1960s. And their experts soon discovered some of these key problems, and they came up with what they hoped would be solutions. One of them was, all right, look, of course, the land isn't flat, so the water's not properly rolling off. So what we will do is we will bring in dozens and dozens of earth movers and bulldozers. We will move the Afghans off their land. We'll flatten the land and invite the Afghans back on to farm their land. But of course, nobody bothered to communicate this to the Afghans, who feared that they were being permanently evicted from their land. So when the American bulldozers arrived, the Afghans simply met them with rifles. Thus began a decade-long process of the U.S. government trying to come up with solutions, but only to be foiled because of a fundamental lack of understanding of Afghan culture and tradition and a fundamental lack of communication with the local people. Finally, in the early 70s, funding ran out, and the American engineers packed up to go home. As the Americans left, Henry Kissinger, who was then Secretary of State, happened to stop off in Kabul for a visit. The Afghan Prime Minister complained to him about the failure to actually get things right. He called the Helmand River Project an unfinished symphony and beseeched Kissinger to get things right. And so Kissinger asked the bureaucracy back in Washington to try again. And this time, the call went out to a tiny little federal agency called the U.S. Soil Conservation Service. And they sent a team of experts out to Afghanistan, and they came up with a solution that was actually maddeningly simple. Simply get the Afghans to dig little drainage ditches by hand using hand tools, something the Afghans could do, ample manual labor there, and you could easily teach them to do it. And on the first farms they dug these ditches on, farm yields increased by 75% in a year. Americans finally had a solution. But before this solution could be implemented across Helmand and Kandahar, there was a communist coup in Kabul, and Soviet tanks rolled into Afghanistan. We had finally found a solution, but it was too late. Time had run out on us. You know, there are enduring lessons in this tale. Contractors have always worked in their own interests long before our modern wars. Massive inputs don't mean rapid results, at least not in Afghanistan. Cultural change will occur slowly, on its own pace, and perhaps most fundamentally, beware those English-speaking, suit-wearing, American-educated Afghans who live in Kabul. They know about as little about the rural parts of their country as we do. Let me read you a paragraph from a USAID study about this grand scheme. Quote, "There's no getting off cheap. Programs to make the desert bloom are enormous and expensive. No success can accrue to aid for a well-designed and well-implemented portion of a project which fails as a whole. Although every constraint does not have to be tackled at once, if provision is not made at the beginning for all essential elements, aid risks getting sucked further and further into a haphazard effort with no prospect of final success." That was written in 1983. That report, and reams of other documents about this project were readily available in Washington. But few in Washington bothered to meaningfully examine this endeavor. Had senior officials in the White House, the Pentagon, the State Department bothered to understand any of this history back in 2009, it might have given them pause before advocating another grand attempt at nation building in Afghanistan. Instead, our government barreled forward with a strategy that had a minuscule chance of working. Now, in my book, I dissect the American approach to stabilizing Afghanistan on two levels. The first is strategically. That is, was the COIN strategy and the surge the right decision? The second is operationally. That is, once the president signed off on the COIN strategy and the surge, how well did the organs of our government, the Pentagon, the State Department, USAID, even his own White House, how well did they implement his policy? Let's start with strategy. And let me state up front that I believe COIN can work if the conditions are right and the cost is merited. But for COIN to have prevailed in Afghanistan, several things needed to occur. The Afghan government had to be a willing partner. The Pakistani government had to be willing to crack down on insurgent sanctuaries on its own soil. The U.S. government had to be willing to commit troops and money for several years. The American people had to be patient enough for security to improve gradually. And the Afghan army had to be ready and willing to assume control of areas that had been cleared of insurgents by American troops. First, let's talk about the Afghan government. President Hamid Karzai never agreed with our war strategy. Isn't having a supportive, credible host nation government a fundamental prerequisite for COIN? We know most Afghans have no great love for the Taliban. They view the Talibs as the religious zealots that they are. And the Afghan people know well what it was like to live under the Taliban. But they have no great love for their own government either. It's because Karzai's government's filled with thugs, warlords, corrupt scoundrels. They abuse people, shake them down for bribes, kidnap boys for pleasure. They don't provide basic services to the population. Of course, the American answer has simply been COIN. If only we can build institutions of subnational governance and we can connect those institutions to the provincial capital and then on to Kabul, the national capital, we can fix this mess. And it was such an appealing idea, but it was fundamentally flawed. That's because Karzai had no interest in letting us succeed. Because if we did, it would disrupt his patronage networks and the deals he has cut with regional power brokers. So he simply undercut reformers and he slow-rolled efforts to build up institutions of local governance. We Americans naively assumed that the failure to get civil servants down to the districts was because of a lack of human capacity. Sure, that was a problem. But the bigger problem was that Karzai simply didn't believe in the venture, and he had his ministers interfere with the process, even when the United States was footing the bill. Look, much of this was our fault. Back in 2002, Karzai did try to do the right things. He wanted to take on the warlords and establish a technocratic government. But when he asked the United States to authorize the deployment of NATO forces beyond Kabul to other major Afghan cities, Defense Secretary Don Rumsfeld said no, because he didn't want to commit additional U.S. soldiers to the country. A few months later, when Karzai asked the military to help remove a warlord-turned-governor out in western Afghanistan who was enriching himself through smuggling and other illicit activities, once again, the United States said no. The view in Washington back then was that American troops were not to engage on what was called green-on-green actions, even if one side was the president on whom our nation was depending. Since we weren't going to provide the muscle to remove the warlords, Karzai engaged in a rational act of self-preservation. He cozied up to them. By the time we and our NATO partners got wise to the damage the warlords were wreaking across the country, Karzai had firmly moved into their camp. Consider Helmand Province down in southwestern Afghanistan. You know, back in early 2005, before the first British troops arrived there, officials back in London knew they needed an Afghan partner in the province, somebody to be a front man for all of their governance and reconstruction efforts in the province. Now, in most places, the obvious candidate would have been the provincial governor, but that wasn't an option in Helmand. They regarded the governor there at the time, a guy by the name of Sher Muhammad Akhundzada, as part of the problem, not the solution, in large part because that year, DEA agents discovered 9.5 metric tons of opium in this guy's house. Now, he claimed that his men had just seized it and they were waiting to turn it over to the proper authorities. But to the Washington and London, this was proof positive of the governor's involvement in drug smuggling. And so the British government made it clear to Hamid Karzai that this guy had to go, and if he didn't get eased out, didn't get removed, that the British would not send troops to the country. So that December, Karzai reluctantly pushed out the governor. Didn't really push him out, he just made him a senator for life and moved him to Kabul. Now, the United States and Great Britain thought it had scored an enormous victory. But the former governor got his revenge. He convinced Karzai to make his nephew the deputy governor, and then he dispatched 3,000 of his henchmen to go off and fight for the Taliban. Now, President Karzai all along felt that he had been forced into making a bad decision by the United States and by Britain. He resented the powerlessness that had resulted from his nation's dependence on foreign assistance. And he had convinced himself by then that the warlords were the key to stability. He told a State Department official during a meeting around that time, according to a cable that was released on WikiLeaks, he said, "The question is, why do we have the Taliban controlling areas 2 years ago when I had control? When Sher Mohammed was the governor there, we had girls in schools and only 160 foreign troops in the province. The international community pushed me to remove him, and now look where we are. My question for you is, do you want a bad guy on your side or working with the Taliban?" Now, Karzai soon convinced himself that the principal problem in his nation wasn't bad governance. It was the infiltration of militants from Pakistan. Now, of course, that is a problem. But what he wanted from the additional troops that Obama authorized was not counterinsurgency operations in Afghan villages. He wanted all those troops on the border with Pakistan. And every time that Karzai lashes out against the United States, well, people in Washington tend to see it as a mark of craziness. But it really is Karzai simply sending us a message. And that message is very simple. I don't believe in counterinsurgency. Now, what about the second condition, the Pakistani government? After the Taliban leadership relocated to Pakistan in late 2001 and early 2002, they were provided a degree of safe harbor by Pakistan's intelligence service, the ISI. Talibs were allowed to meet and reorganize, even reestablish networks inside Afghanistan. But back then, Pakistani spies refrained from giving the Talibs overt assistance. Yeah, ISI officials did meet with a handful of senior Talib mullahs, but Taliban commanders had to raise their own money, they had to acquire their own arms, which isn't that hard to do in Pakistan, but they had to do a bunch of this stuff themselves. Fast forward to 2009. After Obama approves the surge and more troops start flowing in to Afghanistan, the ISI changes its approach. Instead of maintaining an arm's length relationship with the Taliban, they get far more active. Instead of doing what Washington wants them to do, which is cracking down on the Taliban sanctuaries, they start providing weapons and cash and intelligence via intermediaries to Taliban commanders. They take just the opposite position from what Washington had hoped they would take. Now, what about the domestic politics in all of this? Let's talk about the price tag for a second. Was it worth it? You know, it costs, on average, $1 million a year to keep a single service member in Afghanistan. That means in 2010, 2011, the annual tab for the war was about $100 billion a year. Is achieving a marginally less bad outcome in Afghanistan worth that expense? With other pressing security challenges, Iran, North Korea, upheaval in the Middle East, is it prudent to be tying up so many forces and dispersing so many precious dollars in remote Afghan villages? And what of American patience? The surge exhausted it. You know, the war was in its eighth year when Obama decided to surge. Even though many Americans shared the president's view that Afghanistan was the good war, only a slim majority supported his decision to send more troops. Now, although commanders-in-chief shouldn't use public opinion polling to guide strategic decisions, public support is essential for any drawn-out campaign involving tens of thousands of troops, hundreds of monthly casualties, and almost daily fatalities. Had all the other factors played out differently? Had Karzai been a true partner? Had the Pakistanis taken meaningful action against the sanctuaries? Had our nation not been in the throes of economic stagnation? Then perhaps the public could have rallied around such a large war effort. When all those indicators pointed down, public opinion soon followed. Now even a majority of Republicans believe the war is no longer worth fighting. And lastly, the Afghan army. Instead of compelling Afghan soldiers into action, the surge often sent the opposite message. The Afghans simply decided to hang back and let the additional American troops do the fighting. What was supposed to be a good kick in the pants, or at least a golden opportunity to work in tandem with the Americans, instead turned into a crutch. But lest you think I'm all about the negative, the Afghan army has emerged as a rare bright spot in this overall effort, despite a recent influx of so-called green-on-blue attacks. As American troops have started to leave, the Afghans are stepping up to shoulder more of the fighting. And through it all, the Afghan army remains the country's most respected institution. If the country hangs together after American combat forces depart in 2014, it's going to be because of the Afghan army. So what should the president have done back in 2009? Well, I'm not one of those who thinks that we should have simply packed up and gone home. Had we done that, or if we can magically do that tomorrow, it would likely condemn the Afghans to the hell of a prolonged insurgency or another civil war. I think we still have a moral obligation to the Afghan people. When we launched the war in 2001, we made an implicit promise to them that if they stood with us against the Taliban, we'd give them a shot at a better, freer life. But that didn't necessarily require a coin strategy and a surge that tired us out. One of the principal characters in my book, a brave young State Department officer named Cale Weston, who spent 7 years in Iraq and Afghanistan, more than any other American diplomat, argued to me that instead of going big with a surge or packing up and going home, we Americans should have had a go-long strategy. The president needed to determine how many troops he was willing to commit to Afghanistan for 10 years or more. And then he needed to pledge that level of support to the Afghan people. That would have meant no surge. It probably would have meant fewer troops that were on the ground back in 2009. But Cale Weston was convinced that a smaller but enduring force would have been smarter on all fronts. It would have appealed to the Afghans, who chafed at the presence of so many foreign soldiers on their soil. It would have compelled the Afghan army to have more quickly assumed the burden for fighting the Taliban and securing the population. And it would have forced us to focus only on the most essential of missions instead of grand nation-building projects. Afghanistan, he often said, is a marathon, not a sprint. The surge was a sprint, and we Americans got winded way too quickly. Now, despite all of those coin assumptions that turned out to be false, our troops have made remarkable progress there. Parts of southern Afghanistan that were once teeming with insurgents are now largely peaceful. Schools have reopened, as of bazaars. People are living as close to a normal life as possible. But Afghanistan as a whole is still not fully secure. Eastern parts of the country are still in the grip of the Haqqani network, a Taliban faction backed by Pakistan's intelligence servants. And in the south, a critical question lingers. Will the Afghans, whether government, their army, their police force, will they have the willingness and ability to take the baton from American troops as we begin coming home? Will the Afghans sustain the gains? Will all of the blood and treasure that have been expended there have been worth it? Or will it slip back to chaos? That doesn't mean the Talibs, in my view, will be able to roll into Kabul with the same ease as they did in the 1990s. I don't think Kabul's government's going to fall like Saigon's did. The Afghan army, it appears, should be able to protect major cities and other critical areas. But the insurgents will almost certainly expand their control of rural districts, and they'll retain the ability to conduct frequent and spectacular attacks against government and civilian targets. The foreseeable future is going to be messy and chaotic. But many Americans may well see it as good enough. Osama's dead, Al-Qaeda's on the ropes, the Talib leadership has taken a beating. But could have all of that have occurred without a surge? Could we have achieved a similar messy but good enough outcome without hundreds more dead Americans and thousands more gravely wounded? Before I take your questions, I want to turn to the issue of how the surge was executed. I've talked about the strategic disconnect. Now I want to address what I term the operational failure. Agree or disagree, the surge was the president's strategy, and the government beneath him had an obligation to make their best efforts to implement it. But each part of our government made critical errors. Let's first talk about the military. Back in 2009, the most dangerous part of the country, the most at-risk part of the country, was the southern city of Kandahar, the country's second largest city. It's really the spiritual capital for the ethnic Pashtun population. For the Taliban, it was the strategic prize. If they could seize Kandahar, which they were on the verge of doing, they would have a springboard to take over much of the rest of the country, as they did in the mid-1990s. So you would think we would have devoted the bulk of that first wave of 17,000 troops to protecting the areas around Kandahar, to keep the Taliban at bay. Now, instead, we sent them off to neighboring Helmand province, the area where our engineers were digging canals six decades earlier. Now, of course, they were, you know, important to us way back when, but the area we sent those troops to was home to fewer than 1% of Afghanistan's population. Now, our strategy was supposed to be protecting the people, supposed to be counterinsurgency. Why were they out in a part of the country that was home to fewer than 1% of the population? The answer is simple. Tribal rivalries. Not in Afghanistan, but in the Pentagon. That first wave of troops was comprised of U.S. Marines. I love the Marines, spent a lot of time with them, but the Marines insisted on bringing their own helicopters, their own logistics convoys, their own intelligence operatives, and they wanted their own patch of the sandbox, essentially. They didn't want to interoperate in Kandahar, where there were already Canadian and U.S. Army troops fighting. They wanted their own part of the country. And so top commanders in the Pentagon and in Kabul decided to give them a patch of Helmand Province. Now, there were a lot of bad guys to kill there, but it wasn't the most important part of the country. And by doing so, we essentially squandered the first wave of surge troops in the country. Now, what about the State Department? The State Department had promised a civilian surge to match the military surge, not in terms of people, in terms of overall numbers of people, but they were going to send hundreds and hundreds of American diplomats, aid workers, and other experts to go down into the provinces, into the districts. Districts are sort of Afghan county-level sort of organizations, get down into the rural areas with our infantry units to help provide basic local governance, to help provide basic reconstruction. Now, put aside whether setting up local governments was a fool's errand to begin with, whether Karzai was supportive of it. This was the plan on paper, and the State Department had promised it was going to get its people out there to do that. Unfortunately, the civilian surge took place sort of a year too late. Most of those people didn't hit the ground until a year after most of the major military units arrived. And then when those individuals arrived in Afghanistan, most of them wound up staying in Kabul in the very well-appointed embassy compound in the capital with a swimming pool and a bar and whatnot, as opposed to getting out into those dusty forward operating bases where they were supposed to work hand in glove with the military. And instead of getting real subject matter experts, we wind up getting a lot of people who had worked on sort of wasteful projects in Iraq, people who were contractors in the other war who were looking for new opportunities. And the problem, quite frankly, was pretty simple. You know, those responsible for doing hiring at the State Department at USAID simply waited for resumes to come in over the transom. Often it was from people who had worked on other projects who knew how to write applications that had the relevant number of keywords that would then give them a particularly high score on the computers that were grading the applications. Instead of doing what the president should have done, which was call up the heads of Microsoft and Google and Apple and others and say, can you loan me one of your HR people for a year for a very important project? And we could have scoured the country to have found people with the relevant subject matter expertise, the relevant language skills, the people with the willingness to go live in austere conditions for a year or two. I'm convinced that in a nation of 300 plus million people, we have people with those skills. Problem was, State Department and aid didn't go about finding those people. The net result was that we got people who really just didn't, in many cases, have the necessary skill set for the job or didn't have a willingness to be out there. Now, what about the actual business of reconstruction? Now, look, Afghanistan is a dirt poor country. Its rates of infant mortality, malnutrition, illiteracy, they're all off the charts. And Afghanistan was starved of reconstruction resources in the initial years of the war by the Bush administration. But when Team Obama came in, it decided to try to fix all of this. But there is a problem of trying to do too much of a good thing. I mean, think of Afghanistan as sort of a parched man on a hot day. What he really needs is a tall glass of cold water. What we did was we turned, with the best of intentions, we turned a fire hose on the country. In 2010, we tried to spend $4 billion in a single year on reconstruction projects in that country. It simply exceeded the absorptive capacity of the country. I mean, in some parts of the country, it equated our spending in those areas was more than the per capita income for every man, woman, and child. Not surprisingly, it fueled new rivalries in communities, it sparked tensions, and it exacerbated the very corruption we were trying to stem. And then lastly, there was the bureaucratic fight in Washington. You would think, given the importance of stabilizing Afghanistan, the key federal agencies involved in all of this would be sort of rowing together. But instead, we got what I term in the subtitle of the book, the war within the war. And the most pitched battle that I discovered was actually one between the State Department and the White House. And it concerned the subject of reconciliation with the Taliban, not a substantive policy dispute. In fact, the White House and the State Department were of the same view. They were the view that you couldn't kill every last single Talib, that you needed to have some sort of path built toward peace talks with elements of the Taliban, and that a negotiated settlement was really the only viable way to bring the conflict to a close. There was broad agreement on that in Washington, at least among the civilians. I'm not talking about the military or the intelligence community here. So the job of trying to chart that path forward at the State Department was given to Richard Holbrooke, the late veteran diplomat who had been brought on by Secretary of State Clinton, who was a close friend of hers. And Holbrooke was a man who was eminently qualified for this job in some respects. At age 27, he was the youngest American to serve on the U.S. delegation to the Paris peace talks aimed at ending the Vietnam War. In 1996, he had almost single-handedly brokered the Dayton Accords to end civil war in the Balkans. He was a man with an enormous Rolodex and a real will to try to forge another compact to end a war. But he was also a guy with an enormous ego, with very sharp elbows, a thirst for the spotlight, and an incredibly dramatic personality. And that didn't go down so well in a White House run by a president nicknamed No Drama Obama. And so key members of the president's national security team sought to box out Holbrooke at every twist and turn. They denied him the use of government aircraft to travel to the region at times. They scheduled key meetings when he was out of town. They undercut him in front of the leaders of Afghanistan and Pakistan. Holbrooke did his part to stoke the conflict as well. But the bottom line here was that for the first year and a half of the troop surge, the moment when we had the most leverage because we were putting troops into the country, not pulling them out, the U.S. government made very, very little headway on the subject of reconciliation with the Taliban because the principal actors in Washington were far too consumed fighting one another as opposed to working in concert to try to achieve a shared objective. Now, all of that said, let me leave you with a couple of questions here. You know, despite all of the problems with the formation and implementation of our surge policy and COIN strategy, did the Obama administration's approach actually turn out, in hindsight, to be a smart strategy, either intentionally or inadvertently? Did our government add enough forces to turn the tide, even if we didn't accomplish the grand COIN objectives sought by the military? And once the Taliban were being beaten back from key terrain and the Afghan army started to generate critical mass, did President Obama, who had never believed in COIN in the first place, make the right move to commence the drawdown of forces against the military's wishes to essentially force the military to abandon COIN and move with alacrity to a new mission aimed, focused on training the Afghan army and reducing the American footprint. Was all of this intentional, or was it simply a lucky coincidence, driven by frustration and desperation from the White House? Will it work? Is it wishful thinking to believe the Afghans will be able to hold back the Taliban from key population centers? And what are the lasting consequences here for civilian-military relations? Will our military going forward feel manipulated by the civilians, let down by the civilian leadership? And will our civilian leaders, at least those in our current White House, come away feeling that military commanders were intransigent in the way they handled the surge negotiations? I'd like to close by noting that, you know, yes, more Americans did perish on the beaches of Normandy and in the jungles of Vietnam. But in my view, Afghanistan stands alone in the annals of American warfare. It's been our country's longest war, longer than even the Revolutionary War. It's a forgotten war. With no draft, the fighting's been left to a small cadre of professional officers and volunteer grunts. And I think it's perhaps the most complicated war our nation has prosecuted. Our troops have been told to befriend villagers and bombard insurgents with the same fervor, often in the same day. Our commanders have been ordered to fight with fewer forces and in less time than they've wanted. Our diplomats and development experts have been required to work in environments that were far more dangerous than they'd signed up for. All told, I spent 3 years observing fellow Americans attempting to defeat the insurgency in Afghanistan. For a long time, I believed that we could pull it off if only we had enough people, money, and patience. But I'd learn eventually that the real challenge wasn't headcounts, budgets, or public opinion. For all the grand pronouncements about waging a new kind of war, our nation has simply been unable to adapt. Too few of our generals have recognized that surging forces could be counterproductive, that the presence of more foreign troops in the Pashtun heartland is a potent recruiting tool for the Taliban. Too few of our soldiers have been ordered to leave their air-conditioned bases and live among the people in fly-infested villages. Too few of our diplomats have invested the effort to understand the languages and cultures of the places in which they were stationed. Too few development experts have been interested in anything other than making a buck. And too few officials in Washington have been willing to assume the risks necessary to forge a lasting peace. And nobody, it seems, wants to work together. Our good war had turned bad. For years, we Americans have dwelled on the limitations of the Afghans. Perhaps we should have spent more time focusing on our own. Thank you.
The floor, as they say, is open.
Thanks very much. I agree with the spirit of everything you said. The only part where I would perhaps disagree is when you tend to suggest that had things been done otherwise, perhaps it would have been better, or that some gains have been made. You mentioned the army. One study that I'm sure you know recently showed that only one of 24 brigades was actually good for anything. The other one can't fight without the Americans coming in and doing it for them. The army is completely useless. It's shot through with Taliban sympathizers. And of course, it is literally an army of crack addicts. That's one thing. And Karzai himself, which I think we should call things by their name, Karzai is a mafia boss. And the government there is a mafia government. And it's not surprising what he's doing there in terms of nepotism and so on and so forth. And in terms of had things been done otherwise, would it have been different? I think here the correct perspective is that of the interesting British historian Neil Ferguson, whose view is essentially that America should have consciously and deliberately taken on the mantle of an imperial power and committed itself to reconstructing Afghanistan, not over a period of 4 years, 6 years, in other words, over kind of surge-like periods, but rather over a 50-year span, in which you consciously try to relive what the Pax Britannica of the 19th century was. And that's, of course, exactly what the American foreign policy has refused to do. But I think the question is the largest strategic question in terms of Afghanistan. It should not be focused on the surge as an operational or even as a kind of mini-strategic matter, but on whether it made any sense at all to even try to do this over a period of time that was anything shorter than 40 years.
It's a very, very good point. And I think that, there, in my view, there were only sort of two defensible approaches to this. One was a much narrower mission, a CT-focused mission, a light footprint mission that said, look, our national objectives are not to ensure necessarily a credible government in Kabul, not to try to build institutions, but to simply go after any significant al-Qaeda leaders or operatives that pose a threat to the United States or allied interests. Narrow, or what you're talking about, a multi-generational effort to essentially build I'm not going to say rebuild, because there wasn't anything to sort of go back to, build Afghanistan from scratch. And that would have involved scrapping the Afghan constitution, which is a fundamentally flawed document. It would have involved a different approach to sort of Karzai, essentially probably pushing for new leadership in the country. And it would have been an intensive effort from the ground up with many, many, many more troops. And I think, you know, it's debatable whether the Afghan people would have been keen to have supported such a venture. I think that while there was a window of opportunity post-2001 where the Afghans really did welcome foreign assistance, by 2009, tempers and feelings were getting really frayed. The idea of a much larger American presence, I'm not so sure, would have sat very well with the Afghans, particularly one that would have gone on for so many years. But for the bigger footprint approach, I mean, in my mind, the fundamental question, and this is the question that animates these discussions in the White House, is it worth the cost? You know, doing that would be fundamentally, you know, it would be a multi-trillion dollar endeavor. Is getting Afghanistan right worth that expense for the United States? And what is the opportunity cost of doing that? And does it tie you up from engaging in other places in the world? Does it tie you up from engaging in necessary, as the president frequently remarks, you know, the necessary rebuilding that needs to occur domestically? Is Afghanistan really worth that? So say, all right, look, coin can work, you can do this, but do you want to commit those resources? And I would think that a reasonable person would probably conclude, no, it's not worth all of that. But we tried to do something sort of in the middle that was fundamentally untenable with a local partner that was not a local partner, and with outside influences that were fundamentally disruptive to the approach we were taking. Over here.
Thank you for a really quite interesting talk. I very much like your message at the end of the U.S. should have been more conscious of its own limits. And I wonder if you would comment a bit more on these sort of Washington dysfunctionalities that you apparently hold responsible for the conduct of the war, the infighting, the capture of USAID and the State Department by consulting firms. And this is all stuff which really resonates with me in a very different context. I wonder if you could say whether you think these problems are getting worse and more important in the making of American foreign policy, and what to do about it.
The problems certainly aren't getting better. You would think that after the early years of failure in Iraq, we really would have, it would have been a clarion call to have actually started to build this necessary capacity, to tear down some interagency barriers, to also kind of create a more expeditionary corps of civilians that could provide the necessary support to the military for these sorts of operations. And unfortunately, that really hasn't occurred. There was an effort, a bipartisan effort, back starting in 2004, to create what is now the CSO branch at the State Department, Conflict and Stability Operations. It started in 2004, actually, a good idea from three senators, Joe Biden, Dick Lugar, and Chuck Hagel, to create a sort of a civilian response corps to work alongside the military. They envisioned a two-tiered approach, one with civilians drawn from across the federal bureaucracy, kind of trained up with some expeditionary skills, be sort of like an army reserve, and then a civilian component where people with those skills in the private sector or in academia or elsewhere, NGOs, could sign up as reservists to participate. Well, you know, like many good ideas in Washington, it wound up sort of dying a very quick death, or at least not blossoming in the way it should have. You know, the Office of Management and Budget under the Bush White House didn't want to fund it because they didn't develop it. Democrats and the House side didn't want to appropriate money for it because they worried it would lead Bush to go invade another country. Regional bureaus at the State Department didn't want to commit people to it because they didn't want to lose power and influence and cede it over to this new organization. So by 2007, this group had a total of 11 deployable people. Now, it has a few more today, but it's nowhere near what it needs to be. And part of the problem is also that when state and aid look at the civilian surge in Afghanistan, they've created a narrative of success. They've said to themselves, we did a great job. Instead of asking hard questions about did it really work as hoped. So not only do you not have the necessary kind of skill set that is developed, that's ready to go if you need it again. And you know, let's hope we don't need it again, but our government prepares for lots of contingencies we hope will never occur. It strikes me as irresponsible not to at least plan for that. There's a real danger in these key bureaucracies thinking that they performed marvelously well and all they need to do is repeat the Afghan example in the next theater of operations.
Over here.
Thank you for your presentation. I have two small questions for you. Number one is that you talked about how ISI was helping the Taliban, you know, fund them for the first services. I'm trying to understand what was their objective behind it. Why were they funding Taliban? And second, last week I was at a presentation by a friend who's studying here, and he mentioned that the average life expectancy of an Afghani man or woman is 45 years. This brings us to a point that the number of lives people have, Afghans have lost because of this war, and the number of lives people have lost in Pakistan because of the war. And we do talk about the troops who died, which is very unfortunate. But does your book also talk about people who've died in Afghanistan and Pakistan and they're still dying, right?
There's a huge civilian toll. Let me take the first part of your question first. Why is the Pakistani government, why is the ISI, why have they been supportive of the Taliban? Well, there's a perfectly rational reason for them to do so, which is the Taliban serve as their proxies in Afghanistan. If Afghanistan were left completely alone, free from any foreign meddling and interference, Afghanistan would form a closer relationship with India than with Pakistan. And the reasons for this are that the northern Afghans, those who are part of the Northern Alliance, the ethnic Tajiks, Uzbeks, and Hazaras, they're naturally closer to India. The Indians supported them during their civil war with the Taliban. But even for the Pashtun population in the south and the east, many of them look to India as a land of economic and educational opportunity. It's the large potential export market for them. It's where they want their kids to go to school. And this is known to the leadership in Pakistan. It's known particularly to the military leadership. The same military leadership that has justified its claim on resources in Pakistan for decades based on the existential threat that the Indians will one day invade Pakistan and wipe them out. And so that military, that intelligence service, cannot afford to let its arch rival India plant its flag on Pakistan's rear flank in Afghanistan. So it must engage in a set of actions to try to exert Pakistani influence in Afghanistan and, you know, prevent stability in Afghanistan that then leads to a closer Indian relationship. So their principal tool to do that, through the Taliban, which had essentially been nurtured by the ISI over the years, you know, an offshoot of the Mujahideen resistance to the Soviets that, you know, yes, were funded and armed by the CIA, but through the ISI. So, you know, here's an intelligence service that has deep links to these guys. And so they're a principal tool to implement Pakistani policy and to fulfill Pakistani security objectives in Afghanistan. So everything that they're doing, which drives officials in Washington bonkers, is actually totally rational. It's all calculated. And they also understand that despite all the talk from Washington of an enduring commitment to Afghanistan, they know they can easily, they very adroitly read the political winds in Washington, and they know that there's very little appetite for a long-term U.S. commitment in Afghanistan, long-term funding of the Afghan army and such. And so they recognize that this mess is going to be on their doorstep. They're going to be the ones left kind of holding the bag. And so they are taking a set of actions that are in their interest because they have very little confidence that decisions made by Washington, or at least that Washington will fulfill its promises to Afghanistan. And in terms of the human cost, it's been an enormous cost in the Afghan people. We should note that this is not just a modern phenomenon. I mean, this is, or at least a phenomenon of the surge years. I mean, this is, the Afghans have been living under a form of warfare now for three decades plus, and so basic medical care, in addition to the dangers of living in an environment of constant conflict, one where the ground is laced with mines, is one that creates a horrific human cost. You know, not to mention just, you know, in a country that is so poor, you literally have young children who every winter in Kabul freeze to death because they're living in squalid displaced person camps that have no heating, and their families can't afford to buy so much as firewood to warm up their tent. It is shocking just how dire the needs are in that country. I hope that as we, a war-weary country, focus on, you know, bringing troops home and trying to disengage there, that a shifting military engagement doesn't lead to a lack of basic humanitarian assistance to the country. If any of you have seen the movie Charlie Wilson's War, the last scene in there is particularly instructive. When the communists have been defeated, and Charlie is sitting in a committee room in Washington, D.C. on Capitol Hill, fighting for $1 million, just $1 million, for schools in Afghanistan, and can't get it. And will we, as we disengage from Afghanistan, be, you know, unwilling to provide basic humanitarian assistance to the Afghan people that in many cases will be the difference between life and death for them? Over there.
I have an observation and a question. The observation is that in a 15-minute talk on U.S. strategy in Afghanistan, I don't think you ever mentioned the phrase al-Qaeda. It was an indirect reference to it, that this was considered a good war because it was war that had to be fought because the Twin Towers coming down. But I think it's indicative of the drift in U.S. goals and lack of clearly stated goals in Iraq that you could deliver this talk and never mention the reason why the U.S. invaded in the first place. My question was, you identified a tremendous number of factors that vary from individual personality like Holbrooke to bureaucratic infighting to lack of understanding of a cultural context versus history. Tremendous number of factors, but there was one key factor I think you kept circling around and around, and I was wondering if you would admit that this was the key one. It reminded me of the scene from Sebastian Junger's book, War, where he basically describes his one valley, one particularly mm-hmm. violent valley in Iraq from the perspective of one U.S. military unit. But he describes a scene where a Black Hawk helicopter brings in, I think, a deputy minister or something or other from the Afghan government. It was the first time in the lives of anyone who lived in that valley that they had seen a representative of the Afghan government. The theme you kept circling around, and I'm wondering if you'll say this was really a key thing. This is a state where there wasn't a state in the sense of the way the Americans were thinking about it. Even in Iraq, there was a strong state that had collapsed, but there was still an imprint of that state that the U.S. tried to rebuild, and eventually, I think, to some extent, they have. In Afghanistan, there wasn't a central state that exerted authority and power throughout the entire country. It only did that through alliances with tribal leaders and regional folks who could maintain, basically, they could be the Don Corleone in their little corner of the country. That's what Karzai was advocating for the United States, but that's not how the United States understands what a modern state looks like. And it was that central challenge of trying to build a state where one never had an imprint, where one had not existed.
So I agree with everything except two things. First is just on your observation. I did mention al-Qaeda several times, and particularly from the point of view that Biden and crew, those who wanted a narrow approach, wanted one focused on al-Qaeda, and Obama himself said our strategy should be focused on al-Qaeda, although then the implementation of that strategy went far in a far broader way. Now, you're exactly right on the disconnect between sort of the traditional view of the Afghan state and the state, the form of government that the United States has been trying to birth there. And this is a fundamental problem. If I were to sort of try to isolate, just the top few factors, this is right up there. I mean, this is in some ways the flip side of the Karzai problem. Now, it's wrong to, however, say that Karzai wanted essentially just a loose confederation of warlords and power brokers. In the early days, post 2001, he actually wanted a very strong central state. And in fact, if you look at the Afghan constitution, it was a product of the bond process that began in early 2002, or late 2001, early 2002, it on paper centralizes power in the capital to a degree unseen on any other country on planet Earth, save perhaps for North Korea, in a country where the government actually has very few tools to wield that power. So but it gets you to these sort of absurd realities that, you know, Karzai can hire and fire a county level police chief and a, you know, county level, you know, a district governor. That power then creates incentives for enormous corruption and dysfunctionality. Now, that system wasn't just one that the United States jammed down the throat of the Afghans. Many Afghans actually wanted that and wanted it for the best of reasons. I mean, Ashraf Ghani, a former finance minister, wanted that sort of system because he felt if you centralize the resources in the capital, it would reduce opportunities for corruption. Now, unfortunately, the reality has been just the opposite. It's created new incentives for corruption and inefficiency. But yes, we're trying to create a state there, along with leaders of the Afghan government, that is just completely not in keeping with Afghan traditions and norms. And to do so would require a generational commitment, the likes of which, you know, we don't have the stomach for. And this is why fundamental aspects of the COIN strategy were flawed, but the construct itself, I mean, people criticize the United States for going around the world and sort of imposing democracy in places. I sort of laugh to myself, you know, if only we looked at the sort of democracy that makes our country great, right? You know, a healthy balance between the center and the periphery, states' rights. You know, Afghanistan is like the American West writ large. I mean, people have a very sort of healthy suspicion of the central government. You know, people in the Korangal Valley that Sebastian Younger wrote about just want to be left alone. They want some things from the government, but they don't want the government breathing down their neck. And yet, when we go and talk to other countries about democracy, we somehow fail to grasp what's made our country great. And we talk all about centralizing power in the capital and not about how do you sort of equitably spread it to the regions and peripheries, and particularly to place Afghanistan, where, you know, you just don't have the capacity on the part of the government to administer a country like that. I'm not saying that's a call to split the country up. Afghans actually want to keep their country as a whole, but they really, you know, see themselves as more of a loose confederation of little kind of fiefdoms particularly in the rural areas, people in the cities see a greater connection to the central government. But when you get out to the Coringal Valley, yeah, I mean, it's its own little ecosystem.
I'm
just sort of piggybacking on this gentleman. Given the fact that there seems to be a very significant misread on the part of probably both the Bush, you know, let's win the hearts and the minds of the Afghanis, and the Obama, Team Obama, as you identify him. You mentioned ISI and their relationship with the Taliban, and I'm reading a book called Deadly Embrace, dealing with our relations with Pakistan. They've been identified as the probably the most dangerous country on the face of the earth, perhaps with North Korea more recently. But what, based on your endeavors in that part of the country, that part of the world, where do you project all this leading as it relates to U.S. national security? Are we prepared to deal with that part of the world as we withdraw our troops? And I just think that there's a very significant disconnect with the understanding of that part of the world.
Well, I mean, I you know, your references to Pakistan, I think, are, you know, speak to the answer here, which is the real strategic concern for the United States needs to be Pakistan, not Afghanistan. You know, the policy in Washington, long been abbreviated AF-PAC, really should have been PAC-AF. It should have been Pakistan first, and then Afghanistan. And you know, in part, this was, it's how bureaucracies operate, right? We focused on Afghanistan because that's where we could deploy troops. That's where we could do more things. But quite frankly, it was the less important piece of the puzzle. And we took steps in Afghanistan that actually further destabilized Pakistan. You know, it's an interesting thought experiment. You know, if you were to focus on Pakistan first and do what you needed to do there, and then, you know, let Afghanistan essentially fall by the wayside, or your series of actions in Afghanistan would only be those that were in support of your mission in Pakistan, how different would that operation look? And I dare say it would have been, you know, no surge. It would have been ways to sort of seek to build a political consensus in Afghanistan that would have sought to assuage Pakistani fears that they would have a hostile neighbor, while at the same time, you know, trying to convince the, you know, trying to give the Pakistanis a sense of comfort that while convincing them to sort of adopt more of an arm's length relationship with the Taliban. Could you pull that off? Arguably, it's an even more complex problem set than Afghanistan, and might have been another reason why policymakers chose to focus more on Afghanistan than Pakistan. But it skirts the big issue, and we leave Afghanistan with key issues in Pakistan fundamentally unaddressed. It's hard to look at Pakistan and say this country is any more stable than it was 4 years ago. You could argue that it is less. But you know, it could you get to a point where the point of our effort should have been to try to at least make Pakistan incrementally more stable, particularly because they have nuclear weapons, and we have not succeeded in that part of it. Yeah, over here in front.
Sorry, that was actually a question I was going to ask about the nuclear threat. It's really not been, as much of any part of this discussion, but with the destabilization of Pakistan, is that something that are American policymakers concerned with actual direct threats from nuclear weapons being turned over to the wrong hands in Pakistan?
I think that is a ongoing concern. It's a very real concern. You know, for the moment, it appears that the Pakistani stockpile is under the full control of the Pakistani military. But if you get to a point of greater strife in that country, there are factions within the Pakistani military and security services, just like there are factions within any organization, some more conservative Islamist, more prone to sympathize with the Pakistani offshoot of the Taliban or other proxy groups that have been nurtured by the ISI largely to fight in Kashmir, and might rogue elements seek to, now it sounds like I'm venturing in the land of a spy thriller, but sell a warhead or whatnot. Those are, yes, right now this is the stuff of fictional literature, but those are scenarios that are very receive incredibly serious consideration by senior level policymakers, particularly people in the intelligence community, who see them as real possibilities. Just because that arsenal seems to be in relatively safe official hands today is no guarantee that it will be so next month or next year.
We have reached that hour, ladies and gentlemen, when we have to draw to a close. I think it's been a really illuminating discussion. What I think, as a historian and part of the Vietnam War, is I think of the parallels between that conflict and this present one, and the attempts by the United States then, and the French before them, to use what we now call counterinsurgency methods. And it had, shall we say, similar results in that case to this one. But I want to thank you all for coming. And I want to encourage you to come to the front. There are still some books available. And now, finally, ask you to join me in thanking our guests.
Thank you.